Welcome to Behind the Headlines, the Friday news roundup from the Salt Lake Tribune and KCPW. Heard all over the state on Utah Public Radio, I'm Roger McDonough. Today, with ballots landing in mailboxes, we'll talk about the voting process and how to get informed before you do your civic duty. Plus, comments by a Latter-day Saint leader stir controversy. The president's approval rating in Utah takes a dive and more. Joining me for this discussion, Salt Lake Tribune managing editor David Noyce. Hi, Dave. Good morning.
Hi. Good morning.
Oh, we've also got reporter Benjamin Wood. Good morning and welcome back, Ben.
Good morning. Thank you.
And news columnist Robert Gerke. Good morning to you, Robert.
Good morning.
Listeners, if you have questions or comments about the stories that we're covering today, post them at sltrib.com at the Behind the Headlines page there, or you can call us. We're at 801-355-8255. That's 801-355-TALK. Let's begin with some news from early in the week that came out of the General Conference of the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints. And Benjamin Wood, you reported on some changes to some practices and procedures that were announced during the conference. Maybe we can just start there before we head into the realm of controversy that I mentioned earlier in the promotion. The church has some notoriously long services on Sunday, but they won't be as long as they used to be anymore.
That's right. Weekly worship services will be scaled down to 2 hours from 3 hours. Essentially, each period will be truncated a little bit, and the regular weekly Sunday school classes will alternate depending on the week of the month. But the high-level version is a two-hour church instead of three.
Two-hour instead of three. Why, and maybe this is a question for David Noyce, senior managing editor, who also contributed to this story. David, why is that change being made?
Sheer exhaustion on the members' part, probably. it's been in place since 1980, so 38 years. Many members have only grown up with a three-hour block. It will bring some benefits. Energy efficiency, better use of buildings, meeting times, all those different things will be benefited by that. It will really help the global church where they have difficulty staffing all of the different auxiliaries every single week. So we talked to a Mormon bishop in England who was just so grateful for that because he has a hard time staffing all the positions in his lay leadership.
They talked also about, Church President Russell M. Nelson talked about a focus on home as opposed to on, the buildings themselves.
Correct. They're calling this sort of home-centered worship, but church-supported, whereas I think a lot of members may be viewed it the other way around before. They have a new curriculum coming out. They're encouraging members to study the religion at home, also in groups, which is different too, and outside of the church service. So that's how they see it. There are losers in that, of course. If you're a single member, or if you're the only member in your family at home, it's not like you can go home and study with other family members or other people in the house if there's no one else there.
Good point. A focus on home and a shortening of actual services for members of Utah's predominant faith. I mentioned in the intro of the show the comments made during conference that kind of stirred some controversy, and these were comments made by Dallin H. Oaks, who's a first counselor in the first presidency of the church. Ben Wood, what were those comments?
His remarks focused a lot on traditional marriage roles, the marriage between a man and a woman, the faith's emphasis on the family. He also talked a little bit about the distortion, his words, of gender and how the church cannot yield to pressures, legal and social, to accommodate changing gender, homogenizing gender, or stepping away from the traditional family.
Okay. You quote Oakes saying, our knowledge of God's revealed plan of salvation requires us to oppose many of the current social and legal pressures to retreat from traditional marriage or to make changes that confuse or alter gender or homogenize, as you said, the differences between men and women. Is this a reasserting of the church's traditional teachings? What I'm wondering is this something that the church has not been emphasizing as much in recent years, and this is a new resurgence of that?
And that might be a question for Dave. I mean, this topic ebbs and flows in the church. You know, this certainly isn't the first time we've heard this from the pulpit. It seemed like one of the more direct remarks on the topic in the recent memory. But again, this was some pretty direct language, but on a topic that has been talked about before.
Okay. David Noyce, do you want to tackle that as well? Is it a reasserting of traditional teachings, or is it You know, is it circling back to something that the church holds near and dear, or is there a divide, for example, within the church on questions of gay marriage, on accepting LGBTQ people as they are?
It's sort of a yes and no to answer that question. President Oaks has addressed this many times. With President Oaks, it's almost like an itch he has to scratch. He has to talk about this issue a lot. It's very important to him, obviously. Asserting opposition to same-sex marriage, I guess the interesting thing was is that he brought it up in the fact that the church has already said that they accept that it's the law of the land now, move on, but President Oaks didn't move on necessarily. Interestingly, several years ago, President Oaks was on Trib Talk with Jennifer Napier Pierce, our current editor, and he was asked about transgender issues, for instance, and he said, we, as in the church leaders, top-level churches, haven't given it much thought yet at that time. He's obviously thought about it a little bit since that time because he did talk about, though I don't think he ever actually said the word transgender.
He didn't. You have to kind of read between some of the phrasing.
But there's no doubt he was plowing a little bit of territory that hasn't been plowed from the pulpit about maleness and femaleness.
Robert Gerke, I want to bring you in on this as well. You wrote a column about this, and you said that actually, these comments by Oaks seem to be at odds with, to a certain extent, with the church's posturing, maybe.
Well, right, with their with their public posturing, I think they've made some strides in the last several years to sort of be supportive of the LGBT community. And to reach out, we saw the Mormon and gay thing. It was a website they posted in 2016 that had people telling their stories about how they reconciled their attraction, their gender identity, and their religion. And so we saw that. We saw them making some strides in terms of anti-suicide, suicide prevention, particularly again with the LGBT community. It's one of the things that we've heard a lot recently is that people, LGBT people who are raised in a strict environment like the LDS Church, particularly a religious environment, are a lot more likely to commit suicide. And so they've been taking some steps to address this. And so it was a little bit in that sense, at odds with what Elder Oaks said. Now, as Dave mentioned, he's been a general authority since 1984. He's always been a crusader on this issue. He's always been one of the people who, I think Dave put it well, it's an itch he has to scratch. And so it wasn't necessarily surprising for him to make this the focal point of his talk. But I do think it's important to remember that there are people out there in the church who are dealing with these issues in real life, not in some abstract way like Elder Oaks is seeing them. And so I saw on social media, and I know everybody, all of us probably saw it on social media, sort of a lot of outpouring of anger, of sadness that this is the tone they're taking, and these people are they say they're not sinners, they're doing the best they can to reconcile their faith and the life that they're leading.
Comments, and this is what Robert Kirky's pointing out, is comments that maybe caused pain for members and for people maybe who have left the faith. David Noyce, later in the conference, Apostle Dieter F. Uchtdorf made a plea to Latter-day Saints who no longer participate in the faith to come back, and I'm guessing that request would have resonated less with, say, an LGBTQ lapsed member after the statement that Dallin Oaks made. But maybe it wasn't aimed at them.
Well, it's interesting. President Uchtdorf, I guess he's now Elder Uchtdorf, he's not in the First Presidency anymore, widely popular. And he's always sort of been that face. Some would say a better public face on that issue and other issues on that front. He even said to accept essentially members as being painfully imperfect. I thought using the word painfully, I thought was really interesting in referring to things that sometimes members say, and I assume that means church leaders also, that can be hurtful.
I'm going to remind listeners to join this conversation by calling 801-355-TALK. That's 801-355-8255. That gets me back, though, Dave, to the idea that maybe there's a divide within church hierarchy on on this particular issue? Is there a rigid line within Mormonism on this is outside of the bounds of what we believe to be acceptable, or is it more fluid than that? I don't know if that's a tough question.
Are you talking about on LGBT issues in general?
Yeah.
I thought it was interesting the way he phrased the talk, as in the church's teachings require people to oppose same-sex marriage, and he went on about secular thinking and other things too.
Yeah.
Which was an interesting way to phrase it, I thought. Instead of just saying you need to do this, he says, no, you're required to. It's almost like he's trying to convince people that the religion requires that you oppose these things. On the transgender issues, too, like you say, the church has not elaborated much on that. The Mormon and Gay website doesn't even refer to transgender, which was really interesting. We asked specifically about when that was unveiled. So when President Oaks refers to gender as eternal, which is a reference from the so-called family proclamation the church put out 25 years ago, says gender is eternal. And many transgender members are very comfortable with that language. They feel like they were that when they were born in this life, they were born into essentially the wrong body. I think there certainly is among the membership, as Robert said, especially when you bring these issues, since especially on gay marriage, it's already been decided, really all you can do then is inflict some hurt on people.
Right. And so the doctrine is the doctrine, and it's been the doctrine forever. I think I was trying to be clear in my column that I'm not trying to convince the LDS Church to change that, because I think that's pointless. But I do think that I did want people to understand. One of the people I talked to was a father who had a child this family was a good Mormon family, had a child that the doctor said, congratulations, here's your baby girl. And they raised her as a girl, sent her to, you know, young women's and did these things that, you know, that she was expected to do. And then, you know, as she got into her early teen years, realized that that wasn't who, you know, she wasn't a girl. So they tried to convince her otherwise. They tried to fix it through the church. They tried to pressure her, and it created a lot of damage. There was a backlash. She distanced herself from these activities, would go into the bathroom during young women's activities and cry and hide because this child wasn't comfortable. And so, you know, this is the type of thing that real Mormon families are actually dealing with on a day-to-day basis. And I think Elder Oaks' comments inflicted a lot of pain on those people. Now, the church isn't going to change how they approach these issues, or if they do change, it's going to be gradually and over a long period of time. But they have a real problem with this because, especially among the younger generation, they're much more accepting of the LGBTQ members or friends. And I think they have a real problem with driving those people away when the rhetoric is so, you know, such a hard line that you can't be supportive of this person and be a good Mormon.
Okay, so I mean, it sounds to some extent like, Robert, you might advocate for a de-emphasizing of that hard line, but of course, at the same time, an unrealistic expectation to expect a tiger to change its stripes.
I think what I'm emphasizing is that the LDS Church is a Christian faith, and that it needs to focus on the Christian teachings, and that is, you know, love each other, be good to each other. You know, Elder Oaks, in his speech to the women's conference, said that people should be kind, that they should love they should treat each other as they expect to be treated. It's the golden rule, right? And so I think that's the part that kind of gets overshadowed when you start talking about how you have to, you know, take a hardline stance against these people who are in your lives, and they're not going anywhere. And well, sometimes they do go somewhere, but you want to keep them in your lives and support them no matter what.
Ben Wood, Robert Gerke mentioned something. Actually, no, it was David Noyce who mentioned the fact that Oaks also warned about the idea of being cautious of secular and scientific thinking. This was beyond comments about LGBTQ people or interpreted to be about LGBTQ people. What did he have to say about secular and scientific thinking and what members of the faith should see in that?
Yeah, he mentioned how, in his view, scientific facts are not the whole of life. He was making a broader point about sources of information. He talked about distrusting anonymous sources, online sources, in what me and many people perceived as a veiled reference to things like Reddit, things like Mormon Leaks, some of these podcasts and blogs out there that look at and analyze and potentially criticize the operations of the church. But yeah, so he did give this broader message about, you know, not going to secular sources of information on questions of faith, questions of belief, and to kind of take science with a grain of salt, essentially.
Okay. Or maybe to be careful reading Robert Gricke's columns. I don't know.
Fake news.
There was more to General Conference than we have been discussing. And another story that the Tribune covered this week had to do with a request to women by Church President Russell M. Nelson. Nelson urged women to take a break from social media. David Noyce, why did he do that?
Good question. He actually issued, it was a 10-day social media fast, which he did not say when that fast should begin, but he asked the women of the church to stop using social media for 10 days and then re-examine after the 10 days how they felt their lives were different now. Whether social media, I guess, was causing problems for them, if things that they might want to cut out, maybe social media they were engaging in, they felt like they didn't need to anymore. Just to sort of examine their lives. We all know that there's corrosive elements in people who get too carried away with social media, so that's certainly not out of the ordinary to request. He made the same request of youth earlier in the year, only for 7 days, though, for youth.
It's harder for younger people in this day and age, I guess. Yeah. It seems like a good idea for anyone from time to time to have a social media fast. This was a call especially to women. Why just for women?
Well, I think as he was talking to the women's session, I think many people are waiting to see, is he going to make the same request of the men? Because it seems like he's almost obligated to now. It came at a kind of a weird time, actually. First of all, women are being encouraged now to speak up and tell their stories, especially through social media. So a lot of people are thinking it's silencing women at a very time when women need and should be speaking out. Also, it's a month before the election. So a lot of campaigning goes on the internet and social media. So, you know, that was inopportune also.
There were some this caused consternation for female candidates for public office who were members of the faith, who worried that, you know, a month before Election Day was not a good time to get offline. The Tribune's Taylor Stevens spoke with a few members of the faith who are candidates. What did they say they were going to do in light of this request from the church president?
She talked to several. She talked to Michelle Quist, I think, who's running for the Salt Lake County Council in District 4. She talked with another candidate for county clerk. And this, I think, it's like most of them are saying, noting the fact that President Nelson did not say when the social media fast should begin, that they're going to continue to do it, or some are moderating their. I think Amy Winter Newton said she was going to moderate how she was using social media and how long. She talked about how she has to use social media because she has to be in touch with constituents. I think one of the fears is not just the candidates, but what about female voters themselves, you know, getting informed at a very time that they should be.
Yeah. This is something that, you know, you mentioned earlier that there's a women's movement out there that has been galvanized by things like the Supreme Court confirmation hearings for Brett Kavanaugh and by the Me Too movement more generally. Robert Gricke, I want to bring your voice in on this. What about the timing here? Is it at all about wielding political influence, or is it just coincidence? This is October. That's when
I think I kind of tend to side with that, frankly. I mean, I think conference is in October, so the timing is the timing. And so it came out when it came out. Frankly, I think it's probably not a bad idea for all of us to take a break from social media. And I think Dave's right. I think that the President Nelson is sort of obligated now to make the same challenge to men. I think the notion is, you know, we don't want people living their lives through social media, comparing themselves to others through social media. It's a very, you know, as we've seen, as we all know, it's a very shallow, sort of superficial way to live your life. And so it can be corrosive in that way. And I don't think I don't have a problem with people taking a break from it. I think it does, you know, raise these issues with the candidates, with political activism, with activism generally, and with communication and connection. And so, you know, there are good things about social media as well. But I think, you know, you take a step back, you can maybe identify those good things a little easier. So, you know, I hopefully. Look, women are smart enough that if they are going to be, if it's important to them to be politically involved and politically active, they're going to do that. And if they want to moderate, like Dave said with Amy Winter Newton, if they want to step back a little bit or whatever, you know, it's it's they'll find the balance.
Right. Well, maybe conceivably inconvenient timing here. With that, let's head to our first break of the show. And when we come back, we'll talk about the voting process and more. This is Behind the Headlines here on KCPW and Utah Public Radio. We'll be right back.
Programming on Utah Public Radio is made possible in part by our members and Culligan Water of Logan, serving Cache Valley for almost 70 years, providing Culligan bottled water, whole home systems, soft and conditioned water. Hey, Culligan Man, service from the man in blue. Details at CulliganLogan.com.
Utah Public Radio is broadcasting a series of candidate debates organized by the Utah Debate Commission. Up next, it's a debate featuring candidates for Utah's 4th Congressional District. Republican incumbent Mia Love will take on Ben McAdams, the Democratic candidate in that district. That debate will originate from Salt Lake Community College in Salt Lake City. You can hear it right here on Utah Public Radio, Monday evening at 6.
This week on Undisciplined, we're talking about how genes impact plant growth, but from two very different perspectives. Our first guest is learning how genetic manipulation can be used to grow trees faster for economic purposes. And our second guest is studying how gene flow impacts our ability to restore wetlands for environmental purposes.
I'm with KCPW Public Radio, and I'm joined this hour by Salt Lake Tribune Managing Editor David Noyce, reporter Benjamin Wood, and columnist Robert Gerke. This is our Friday morning news roundup. Join us with your questions and comments at 801-355-8255, or you can post them at the Behind the Headlines page at sltrib.com. Let's jump into politics and government and elections, and let's start, Managing Editor Dave Noyce, with something that may or may not mean all that much in the upcoming election here in Utah. A new poll shows the approval rating of President Donald Trump has sunk further in the state of Utah than it has in any other state. Tell us about this poll, Dave.
It's a poll. We actually have two polls now we could talk about probably, but right. Morning Consult had a poll. Thomas Burr, our Washington bureau chief, wrote about this week. It shows, I believe, that when Trump was inaugurated in January 2017, his approval rating in the state was 58%, and now it has dropped to 45%, whereas his disapproval rating at the time was 38%. When he first was inaugurated, and now it's 50%. So that's like a 32-point swing or whatever, which makes it the deepest, I think, with a couple of other Intermountain states that his approval rating's gone down. So.
Some context here that might be useful is that Utah wasn't exactly a pro-Trump state from the outset. I mean, you talked about the drop, but before that, Trump had some problems in Utah, especially in the campaign season leading up to the election.
Yeah, I guess the interesting thing is that although he carried the state, but by a much smaller majority, didn't get a majority, that Republican candidates usually coast to in this state. As a matter of fact, his approval rating right now is at 45%, which is what his vote was in 2016.
The state did help elect him into office once he became the Republican nominee. But there were other problems. You know, Mitt Romney called him a phony. Jason Chaffetz, I think it was, who said that he wouldn't be able to look his daughters in the eye. Is that correct? Was it Jason Chaffetz who says that? If he voted for him, he wasn't well regarded by Latter-day Saints, but there's been a warming to him here, his action on public lands being maybe the pillar of his success in Utah.
And I think a lot of people like his Supreme Court. They wanted a conservative on the Supreme Court. That's a big get, they feel like. And so getting two conservative Supreme Court justices on the court, they like that, even though this last one was a painful process, obviously.
Hmm. And there was some polling on that itself. Residents of Utah aren't necessarily favorable of Trump's performance, but they are fans of the new Supreme Court Associate Justice Brett Kavanaugh.
Yeah, we have a new poll out, Tribune and the Hinckley Institute, that shows that I think it was 54-55% of Utahns support Kavanaugh's nomination to the court, and obviously now he's on the court. Interestingly, it's the same for men and women, which really stunned me, actually, that it would be the same given the issues that surrounded Kavanaugh's appointment and his process with him being accused of sexual misconduct by three women.
Just in terms of Trump's diminished approval rating here in Utah, I feel like there's probably one election, maybe one and only one election where this could have any effect, and that's in the competitive 4th district race. Robert Gerke, columnist at the Tribune, mm-hmm. will distaste in Utah for President Trump mean anything in that race?
I think it probably will, because as Dave mentioned, with an approval rating around 45%, we don't actually have the full crosstabs by district, but you can assume that his approval is actually lower in the 4th district, because that is tends to be the most at least moderate district in the state, and so it could play an impact. I mean, we've already seen Mia Love trying to, you know, make the case that she's not a Trump follower, that she'll sometimes support the president when he's right. I mean, this is the fine line that Republicans have to walk. Mitt Romney, during the debate last week with Jenny Wilson, had to say, you know, he defended Trump, saying we shouldn't talk about impeachment. You know, I agree with him on taxes, and he disagrees with him on tariffs. You know, they're trying to thread the needle to associate themselves with the Supreme Court justice, for example, but distance themselves from some of the behavior. I think it does play an impact, because on the flip side, it's going to be motivating Democrats to come out and vote. We've already seen Democrats have gained 20,000 registered voters over the Republicans. Republicans lost about 11,000. Democrats gained about 9. So that makes a difference. I mean, not a huge difference. It's only about 2% of the total electorate, but it does make a difference. And we saw Ben McAdams also this week saying that, you know, he's not going to vote for Nancy Pelosi. So he's sort of got the same sort of this. I mean, that's typically what Democrats have had to do. They've had to walk the line with Nancy Pelosi or Barack Obama. Now we're seeing Republicans trying to walk a similar line with Donald Trump.
Distancing themselves from the leadership of their party, essentially. Mm-hmm. Just on the topic of elections, I mean, turnout is what's going to make a difference on all of this. And Ben Wood, ballots have been mailed out. Mail-in ballots are, you know, out there. I've received mine. Most of Utah's counties are voting by mail. Is that correct? Most Utah?
Yeah, all but two this year.
Okay. Well, can we talk about deadlines? If I've got a ballot that came in the mail, how, where, and when do I turn it in, Ben?
So it has to be postmarked by the day before the election at the latest. Elections folk will tell you that just because you put it in your mailbox doesn't mean it gets postmarked that day. So they're saying you might want to mail it before the Friday prior to the election. The simple answer is just vote and get it in as quick as possible. I mean, don't waste time. Get it in your mailbox. Get voting.
There are dozens of drop boxes around the county here in Salt Lake County as well, where you can put your...
And on election day, you can take it to the polling location and drop it in a box if you
One other thing that I think is important is the registration. We are doing some different things with registration this year that we haven't done before. You can register online up until, I believe, October 30th is the deadline to register online. And frankly, I would suggest you do that, because you can also register on election day at the polling place. You take your driver's license and a bill in there so you can prove your residency, but you may have to wait in a long line, so it's better to get it done early. From the looks of it, we're seeing some enthusiasm this year. People are interested and eager to vote.
Here's a question that I'm going to direct at all of you. Voters are going to decide the fate of ballot initiatives. They are going to decide whether Mitt Romney or Jenny Wilson replace Orrin Hatch, whether to send Mia Love back to Congress or her challenger, Mayor Ben McAdams. We've been talking about the mechanics of voting. What about how a person should get informed about voting? I mean, we have journalists here. I'm not going to ask you to tell people how to vote, but how should a person, you know, get informed when they're looking at their ballot?
Are we going back to Elder Oaks and not trusting secular sources
of
information?
I've found coins to be very good at flipping.
Yeah, right. Read the Tribune. That would be the first thing I would mention. There's also VoteUtah.gov, of course, which has pros and cons of the ballot initiatives and all the candidates and things like that. So you can go there.
You know, the other thing I think, and not enough people do this, but there are opportunities to meet these candidates, particularly legislative candidates. They're falling all over themselves to try to meet you because they don't have money, they don't have a big platform. They campaign in these races by meeting people face to face, and so go to your candidate's website, figure out where they're going to be. They're doing public events, and they want to meet you and talk to you. And you know, there's a lot of opportunities for that. Also, sltrib.com. Ben had a great explainer this week on sort of a rundown of everything that's on the ballot, and it's incredibly useful piece of information.
I mean, there's judicial retentions, there's constitutional amendments, there's propositions. It's a lot to, you know, you might receive your ballot and not be expecting some of these
things.
Yeah,
judicial retentions, they do just scoring, I guess. There's a commission that does reviews, and there's a whole pamphlet you can read. And again, as Dave mentioned, vote.utah.gov.
That's one of the beauties of vote by mail also is you can see, oh, I didn't know that was on the ballot. Now you can go study, you know. So
that's a good point. Get informed in advance. Another thing you might do is watch a debate, which could be a good strategy for learning about, you know, where your candidates stand. And Ben Wood, you covered one this week, the Senate race between Mitt Romney and Jenny Wilson. This was in Cedar City, and it was a pretty friendly affair, wasn't it, Ben?
Oh, tensions flared. It was this was about the most respectful and amicable debate I've ever seen. The candidates down in Cedar City, they went back and forth for about an hour. If you want to ask me specific questions, but essentially the responses you would have expected.
I mean, they talked about working with each other and how much they liked the other person.
Complimentary. They talked about working together in the past and how nice that's been.
How did they distinguish themselves from each other?
I mean, some of the big points were, you know, Trump came up a lot. Jenny Wilson obviously isn't much of a fan. Mitt Romney, depending on the day, lands in different areas there. They talked a lot about public lands, immigration. Jenny Wilson is more of an amnesty-minded person. Mitt Romney is more of a, you know, physical border wall type of candidate. There's also a lot of talk about trade tariffs and budget and kind of the whole grab bag.
You can see a full version of this at the Utah Debate Commission's website if you want to. I came out of it wanting to vote for Bruce Lindsay. No, I'm kidding. Robert Gerke, Jenny Wilson trails pretty substantially in polling in this race. Should she have done something else in this debate to you know, other than being friendly to Mitt Romney? The two of them seemed kind of buddy-buddy.
Well, I mean, there's two ways to approach it. You can approach it as I'm going to go after him, you know, with gloves off and try to beat up Mitt Romney, which could backfire on you, particularly if you're Jenny Wilson and have a political career ahead of you. You'd want to maintain that sort of, you use this as a platform to try to appeal to more mainstream voters and get your name out there and get a little publicity. And people will say, well, I'm still going to vote for Mitt Romney, but I kind of like that Jenny Wilson, you know, and then when you run for county mayor, perhaps in a couple years from now, you can use that as to sort of propel you forward. I think she probably chose the latter. She didn't take a lot of risks. I think her answer, I think the most interesting exchange between the two was on immigration. I think Jenny drew a pretty clear distinction between her and Mitt Romney on that. Mitt sort of softened his position that he's taken. He said he's a hawk on immigration. He's tougher than Trump and so forth. She was pretty effective in talking about a compassionate immigration policy that, you know, that in drawing a distinction between her and Mitt Romney there. It was a pretty, you know, it was a pillow fight. You know, they didn't take many good swings or jabs at each other. Mitt Romney is a good debater. The guy's done this for a long time.
A lot of practice in
gubernatorial debates in Massachusetts, Senate debates. He debated Ted Kennedy in Massachusetts, was a pretty good debater in his own right. He did presidential debates, so it's old hat for Mitt. And I also think he probably played it pretty conservatively. I mean, both literally and, you know, figuratively speaking, to try to, you know, don't make mistakes. And so this was going to be the only time they're on the same stage, probably. So he just wanted to kind of run out the clock in a way.
Okay. It's another one you can actually watch. I think at the Tribune's website there is a stream of this full debate.
Yeah, we have a live stream embedded, or the Utah Debate Commission has their channels playing it.
Great. Listeners, check that out at either website. In the meantime, we are going to take another quick break here on the show. When we come back, anger in Utah over a Trump administration immigration proposal. This is Behind the Headlines here on KCPW and Utah Public Radio. Back in a minute.
Some emerging sounds at the cutting edge of Celtic roots music absorb influences and styles from the Celtic heartlands and around the world. Let's follow the music where it takes us this week on The Thistle and Shamrock.
Tonight at 9 on Utah Public Radio.
Hi, I'm Steve Williams, host of Jazz Time here on Utah Public Radio. I hope you'll join me Sunday evenings for a journey through the world of jazz music. From ragtime to bop, from Havana to Logan, Utah, tune in for a bit of history, commentary, the occasional interview, and of course, all that jazz. Jazz Time, Sunday evenings at 6 o'clock on Utah Public Radio.
Welcome back to Behind the Headlines. I'm Roger McDonough with KCPW, and I am joined by the Salt Lake Tribune's David Noyce, Benjamin Wood, and Robert Gerke. This is our Friday morning news roundup, and you can call us with your questions and comments at 801-355-8255 or post them at sltrib.com. Benjamin Wood, there is a proposal from the Trump administration to change how green cards are approved or renewed. The gist of the proposal is that if an immigrant has enrolled in Medicaid or food stamps, that that would be kind of a strike against them. Can you tell us about that?
Right. So this proposal would consider a person's dependency on government programs in consideration of their green card and resident status.
Yeah, I think I said green cards when I meant food stamps on that last.
These are green card applicants.
Yeah.
And so, yeah, if they're on food stamps, if they're in affordable housing programs, that could be counted against them as they try to obtain a green card.
Okay. And this is, I mean, they are legal immigrant green card holders.
Right.
So if they are on Medicaid or if they have been on food stamps, then that might be a deportable offense, essentially.
Yeah. So this is people who are in the country legally. They have not entered illegally and they are looking to stay. And depending on the degree to which they rely on government assistance, they might not be able to.
Okay. And this is something that wouldn't have been considered or wasn't taken into account when green cards were renewed in the past. This new rule would mean that would be considered. There's pushback on this locally. This is where the story comes in at the local angle. Ben, who's behind that pushback?
Various groups that advocate for low-income communities, you know, they see this as problematic. The idea that we might kick people out of the country because they're on hard times. So there is a lot of, you know, vocal pushback to this, which is just a proposal at this point. It hasn't been, the ink is not even wet, I don't think. It's still just kind of being talked about. But there is a concerted effort among low-income advocacy organizations to stop this.
Okay. And the worry is that people who need assistance may now forego that assistance so that they don't end up getting deported. A quote from the statement by these groups reads, we fear that the rule could chill access to critical programs that help Utahns and their families access essential needs, including health care, food and housing, and that this proposal ignores the contributions of working immigrants and so on. Yeah, I don't know. There's been a call also for Utah leaders to reject this proposal. Have any Utah leaders heeded that call as of yet or responded to this, Ben, do you know?
Not that I'm aware. I mean, this is a relatively new proposal. It's still kind of in the early stages.
Right. Yeah.
I think people are still in the process of getting their, you know, wrapping their hands around it and figuring out what's happening.
There's it's a Department of Homeland Security proposal, a proposed rule change, and there will be a 60-day public comment period open. Robert Gerke, a lot of countries, you know, when you arrive, at least before, you know, you get permission to live there, they want to see proof that you can sustain yourself financially. Green card holders are usually in a different situation than someone showing up at the border. You're supposed to be a legal permanent resident,
mm-hmm.
But this proposal, you know, if you're poor, you become a target.
Right.
What's your reaction?
It's kind of mind-boggling because if you think about it, when you first come to a new place, I mean, I haven't done this, but I would imagine you come to a new place, it takes you a while to get a foundation under you, get on your feet and kind of get that job, get those kids in school, get, you know, be able to sustain yourself. And sort of that transitional period, you might need some help. And we kind of want you to get that help because we want your kids to eat. We want your kids to have access to health care. We want them to get immunized. We want you to be able to have a place, have a roof over your head, because without those things, you can't start that journey to sort of becoming a productive member of society. And so to pull that rug out from under people when they're trying to make this transition into a new life in a new country is I think short-sighted, and it also, but you know, it's what we've seen from this administration, and is that they want to target, you know, these immigrants, whether they're legal, whether they're illegal, whether they're coming from, you know, Mexico or whether they're coming from Africa. It doesn't matter. They don't like immigration. And so it's par for the course for the Trump administration, but it also, I think, is incredibly short-sighted, and it's good that the Salt Lake City, Salt Lake County are speaking out against it, and these low-income advocates, because really, I mean, that's where the resistance is going to have to come from to this, because I don't think these immigrants are going to have to, you know, stick their necks out and speak out against it themselves. So hopefully it's something that, you know, we see it broadly spread, this resistance, and the administration has the good sense to reconsider. And if they don't reconsider, it's going to be another one of these heavy-handed immigration edicts that's going to end up in the court system, I think.
Right. It's always a hot button issue, immigration policy. You know, we'll see, I guess, what happens from what comes from the statement and from the advocacy by these groups to push back against what the Department of Homeland Security is proposing. David Noyce, Tribune managing editor, as we near kind of the end of our program here, reporter Brian Maffley had a story this week saying that Utah, the state of Utah, has just lived through the driest year on record. How far back does our record keeping go, Dave?
This is a report from NOAA, the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration. Anyway, 1895. That's what it goes back to, is 1895. And I actually don't think the findings probably surprised many people. We know it was a very, very dry year, and the years are increasingly becoming dry. It was also the second hottest average temperature year on record. Which another thing I don't think would surprise a lot of people. It's just another evidence of climate change.
Hmm. Yeah, and actually Brian McInerney, who's a hydrologist with the National Weather Service and based here in Salt Lake City, said that, this is a quote from Brian's article, "The weather pattern over the western United States contributes to this because of high pressure has been increasing since 1980. That's indicated by a lack of storms and hot weather in the summer. It's climate change. This has been going on in earnest since 1980. Nothing new. Now it's hitting home. We waited too long to really get after this, and now our window of opportunity to stop this is closing rapidly." I mean, he's pointing very directly at climate
change. That's the scary part of the quote, actually, is that end. And another thing that we've been told by scientists for many years, that the window's closing if it hasn't already closed, but there still are opportunities and chances, of course. The irony is, of course, the day this article came out, it was raining here quite a bit. Because it was said in the story, you know, there was a hurricane on the other side of the continent that helped push out what was this high pressure system that was, remember, we were in like 90s and then suddenly dropped really suddenly. That's why. Hmm. But they say dry years are going to be more common 4 out of 5 times. 4 out of 5 years, it's going to be dry, almost record dry. And it threatens huge economic things like ski industry, things like that.
Yeah, and we have this new report from the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change that says, we have to act much, much faster than we previously thought because changes are happening quicker than originally anticipated. Robert Gerke, Lake Powell is less than half full. Yeah. The same goes for a lot of reservoirs here in Utah. It's kind of terrifying reporting here.
It is. And 1 year, if it was 1 year, it would be a fluke, right? We could write it off and say this is, you know, just the weather is not the climate. That's a common refrain I hear from, especially from conservatives who want to push back against some of the climate science. But when you see repeated trend, when you see, as Dave mentioned, 4 out of 5 years are dry, and you see it, and you see the impacts of that, it's frightening, actually. And you know, you mentioned Lake Powell. I went camping down in near Beaver this year, and we were going to camp near this reservoir, and we get there's no reservoir, it's dry. We saw fires. We're going to see increasing fires over the coming years. Dave mentions it threatens the ski resorts, it threatens not just our way of life, it threatens global stability. You mentioned this international report about how it's going to be a major cause of migration because there's going to be famine, there's going to be droughts. It's daunting. And you know, we have been slow as a country, we've been slow as a state to sort of take the steps that need to be taken or the steps that we can take to try to address this.
Is, you know, as a state that prides itself on planning, on preparedness, you know, at least that's the rhetoric that we have here, is Utah willing to be part of the global action to address climate change and, the urgent action that is needed, apparently?
I think we've seen the state sort of taking some early, you know, some small steps in that direction. We were late to do it, but we've kind of been moving in that direction a little bit. But you know, with this love affair that that state leaders have with coal, we want to keep burning the fossil fuels. But we, you know, and it's important. That's important to our way of life too. But we need to take a longer term look at this. You know, the more coal we burn, the faster we accelerate the climate change, and the more on the backside we see the impacts of that. We're seeing the impacts of that now, as Brian McInerney said. You know, and maybe we've waited too long.
David Noyce, I've seen editorials around the country saying that we're all distracted by the latest tweets and political stories, and that this is what we should be putting all of our attention on because of the consequences. I don't know what the question is for you, other than to say, from a newspaper position, is that something that you guys take into account?
I can't speak for the editorial board,
right,
but
sure.
Yeah, certainly. Interesting too. Young people are much more cognizant of this issue. Polling shows their future in many respects more than maybe ours. That's being gambled and jeopardized with. You know, you're talking about there are steps taking. I think I see it more on the municipal level. Like Salt Lake City, of course, obviously a sort of a blue island in this red state. Park City, places you can think of that you would expect to be a little bit more progressive on this issue. And the problem is it needs more support from everybody in the state. And now you see some retrenchment starting to happen around the world. You know, you've got a candidate for president in Brazil right now talking about backing out of the climate accords, as President Trump did, you know, and that's Brazil, where the Amazon is and the rainforest. It's a little frightening, sort of the bat. You know, there were some great advances made with the Paris talks and the climate accord, and the sort of stepping back now. It's kind of counterintuitive as to why that's happening.
Well, it's scary reporting. You can check it out at sltrib.com. This is Brian Maffley's story on Utah having its driest year on record and its second hottest year on record that we've just lived through. With that, let's move now to our underplayed stories of the week. Who's ready with an underplayed story? Ben Wood?
Sure.
Okay.
Obviously, there's a lot of questions on voters' minds this year. One thing that our Senate race is not a referendum on is fry sauce. I had the chance this week to talk to both Mitt Romney and Jenny Wilson about fry sauce, and I'm relieved to report that both candidates favor fry sauce.
So you're saying they agree again on something? So
they do. Well, I was really hoping one of them would hate fry sauce, because that would have just blown this race wide open. But no, both Mitt Romney and Jenny Wilson like
Are tater tots an appropriate vehicle for fry sauce? Is a question that I have.
I think anything's an appropriate vehicle for fry sauce.
No. And we're going to have to disagree.
Yeah,
on
exactly.
I need to find a third party candidate, I think, because this is a deal breaker.
What were you saying about fake news earlier, Gerke?
Yeah. Robert Gerke, do you want to go with an underplayed story of the week next?
Sure. This is a story that I believe is in today's paper. Tommy Burr did a story about Orrin Hatch signing on to a Supreme Court brief in this case that says that prosecutors shouldn't be able to try the same person for the same crime at federal level and at the state level. And there is some pushback against Senator Hatch on this issue because they say it could impact the way that prosecutors are able to handle charges coming out of the Mueller investigation. Hatch's office says this has nothing to do with the Mueller investigation. It's something that Senator Hatch has felt for a long time, that this is sort of an equivalent of double jeopardy. And so, you know, this case is making its way to the Supreme Court. Again, Senator Hatch taking a little bit of heat for this, and it's something to continue to watch.
Could it provide some protections for Trump administration officials if the Mueller investigation comes after them?
Yeah. I mean, we've seen it before where federal officials have declined to prosecute state officials. State prosecutors have gone ahead and filed state charges when they can find a nexus there. And so it does take that option away. The counter argument to it is that you shouldn't have to defend yourself from two different, in two different systems from two different prosecutors.
Okay, well, it's an interesting story again, and you can check it out, Tommy Burr's article, also at sltrib.com. David Noyce, Your pick for underplayed story.
I was batting around several, but I'll go with this one just so I can say the word Mormon. Nate Carlisle had a story. I can't say it was underplayed necessarily because it was below the fold, but it was on A1, but it was below the fold at the bottom of the page. And Robert's one he mentioned was at the top of the page. So anyway.
Not necessarily underplayed, but okay. A story.
Anyway,
of note.
Okay. One that people aren't talking about. Nate Carlisle
Nobody
did a story.
Nobody reads the print edition anymore.
Come on. Yeah, what is this fold you're referring to?
It's just showing my age, guys. Mm-hmm. Okay. So Nate Carlisle had a story about where he interviewed polygamous and fundamentalist groups, and they're perfectly happy to embrace the word Mormon and own that word. Hmm. It's interesting just because that was one of the reasons in earlier churches' efforts to because they have tried before to try to get people to stop using the word Mormon because they wanted to disassociate with those groups. So this may happen if generations down the road, if mainstream followers and the media all follow suit and don't use the word Mormon to talk about the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints, eventually the FLDS, Apostolic United Brethren, those fundamentalist groups could own the word Mormon. And when we say Mormon, that's who you'll be talking about.
Wow. That's a really interesting, the claiming of the term Mormon by a different group because the window has been open for them by mm-hmm. the Church of Jesus mm-hmm. Christ of Latter-day Saints. Interesting pick from David Noyce for his pick for Underplayed Story of the Week. For my part, I remain pretty fascinated by the story of the Four Corners potato. I don't know if it would be something that I would put fry sauce on. We'd have to see.
Well, of course you would.
Of course I would.
No.
It has...
Wrong.
No.
So it's something that has survived in the wilds of southern Utah for nearly 11,000 years. It was a powerful source of nourishment for the American Indians living around the Escalante and Bears Ears regions. And it was eaten by Mormon pioneers, or pioneers of the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints. The Tribune's Kathy Stevenson wrote about a dinner that featured these little potatoes that took place at the Natural History Museum of Utah. Basically, I'm telling you all of this because I just really want to try this potato, and that's my pick for Underplayed Story of the
she
Week.
She didn't bring any back either to the office. So.
Oh, yeah. Oh, well. You can check that out and all of the stories that we've been covering at sltrib.com. And a quick note that earlier on the show, we talked about voting and what will be on your ballot. The KCPW program In the Hive featured a conversation with Salt Lake City Mayor Jackie Biskupski on the $87 million bond for street reconstruction that is on the ballots of Salt Lake City voters. You can check that out at kcpw.org. David Noyce, Benjamin Wood, and Robert Gerke, all with the Salt Lake Tribune, thank you very much for being here today.
Thank you.
Behind the Headlines is a co-production of KCPW and the Salt Lake Tribune and is heard across the state on Utah Public Radio. Many thanks to everyone who helps make this show possible, including Jesse Ellis here at KCPW, the team at Utah Public Radio in Logan, and the show's producer, Emily Means. Again, podcasts of this show and all of our local programs are available at kcpw.org or through your podcast app. I'm Roger McDonough. Thanks again for listening to us. Have a great weekend.
Hey, I'm Saroja Coelho, sitting in for Tom Power. Delmar Abu-Zaid is making TV history as the first Black character in Avonlea on the show Anne with an E. We chat about the stories Lucy Maud Montgomery did not tell in Anne of Green Gables. That's coming up on Q from PRI Public Radio International.
This afternoon at 1 on Utah Public Radio.
On the next Radio Lab.
Crazy things happen when you translate crazy texts.
We get lost in translation.
A-A-B-B-C-C-G.
It started to tickle.
Takes a little longer to say.
Kabari's Asabui.
Sounds like something that might happen to your car.
Translation on the next Radio Lab.
Tomorrow at noon on UPR. Utah Public Radio is a statewide service of Utah State University and the College of Humanities and Social Sciences. KUSR Logan, KUSK Vernal, KUSL Richfield, KUST Moab, KCEU Price, KUSUFM Logan. Also heard at upr.org.